Hi, and welcome to the Green Business All-Star Podcast, where we interview environmental entrepreneurs and other environmental business leaders who are making a positive impact on our planet and a profit. Our guests share their stories of passion and determination, highlighting the environmental problems they're trying to solve and the innovative solutions they've developed. We explore different types of green business opportunities available to you, the tools, the resources to help you start your own green business or work for. You can have a positive impact on the planet and also make a great living. It's time for you to live your life's purpose, make a difference in the world, and have enough money to enjoy it. Hi, and thank you so much for taking the time to listen to the Green Business All-Star Podcast today. In today's episode, I talk with Vince Dixon of Who Knew Collapsible Cups. Vince shares his journey from the idea to where the company is today. We talk about how he took the idea from in his head to designing the prototype for manufacturing, to sales, to the successful business he has today. We talk about his viral crowdfunding campaign on Kickstarter, bootstrapping the business, and how Who Knew was featured on the Today Show. We dig deep into the importance of customer feedback, his Kickstarter journey, bootstrapping, and to sales and working with freelancers, and a whole lot more. I hope you enjoy the interview. Today on the show, we have Vince Dixon with Who Knew Cups, Foldable Cups. And after finding out that over 165 million single-use plastic cups end up in landfills every day, Vince Dixon went looking for a reusable alternative that was convenient and easy to carry around all day. He couldn't find one, so he created Who Knew, a reusable cup that folds down small enough to fit into even the tightest of pockets. After a viral crowdfunding campaign, Who Knew can now be found in over 70 countries. Vince, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for that intro.
Yeah, the product that you have is amazing. It does fold down very small and does fit in your pocket. I can't wait to hear more about it. But before we talk about that, if you could just give us a little bit about your background and, you know, where did Vince come from before Who Knew Cups?
Yeah, so a bit of a varied background. I originally studied finance, so quite far from where I am now. After university, started a travel business, spent a few years building that up. It was a great experience. And we sort of ultimately wrapped that up probably 2012-ish, at which stage I ended up in New York, and the years since got involved in the fashion industry and in modeling. So that's been sort of a steady background to my life over the last decade or so. And in between that, I've always been involved in sort of on the entrepreneurial side. I'm always looking at various things I can get involved in and generally try to, I'm sort of driven by stuff that I find meaning in. So I've tended to move towards that, often in the creative field and something with sort of some meaning that in my own view can add some sort of positivity to the world. So I was involved in a media company. I did sort of adventure travel and sports media and kind of creating content. And then in 2019, by complete coincidence, was sort of looking for something similar. Couldn't find it, something incredibly highly sort of portable that we could use to use less plastic. It was really living in New York, realizing how much plastic waste was produced on a daily basis, coffee cups being a huge source of that. Went looking for something. Everything out there was sort of the chunky, big thermal mugs that are around. And I just never had it on me, never used it, and thought there had to be something better, couldn't find it. And that was where the idea for Who Knew came about. So we came up with a product and in 2020 launched it on crowdfunding just as a sort of test case and to see what the response was like, and had this incredibly great sort of viral campaign, clearly demand for it, and have spent really 2021, we launched officially and have spent the last few years building it up, yeah, and really getting the product out there as far and wide as possible. And now in the process of building that business into more products and getting it out to more people.
So how did you came up with the idea of collapsible? That's what first popped into your head about having a smaller, or how did you go from there's got to be something better, I want something smaller that I can fit in my pocket, to this fantastic product that you've developed?
Yeah, I mean, it's a classic example of building the thing you need yourself, I suppose. The thinking was along the lines of, in the future, there's going to be a lot less sort of plastics going to be or disposable items are going to be a lot less acceptable. So it's going to be a matter of not sort of, should I take my own utensils or should I take my own cup? You sort of almost have to. And in Europe, that's happening a lot more. They're a little bit ahead of the US. Mm-hmm. Companies like the Netherlands have now outright banned disposable cups. So it is coming. And the realization for me was that I just would not carry around mug or a thermos cup. I just wouldn't have it. So could I have something in my pocket that worked the same as sort of my wallet or my phone or my keys, where I just left the house and I slapped it in there and I didn't think about it, and when I needed it, it was there. And obviously the collapsibility element was a huge part of that, of designing something that could get as small and portable as possible. But really the portability was the sort of design criteria that we worked on.
So speaking of design, how did you get the design? Did you design it yourself? Did you hire somebody to help you with that? Did you need to get an engineer? How do you go from, you know, again,
ideas? Yeah, so it was a learning curve. It's the first product of this sort I've been involved in from a business sense. So it was a huge learning curve at the beginning of sort of figuring out what that path is to actually taking an idea from in your head and then creating something tangible out of it. It started off by looking what was out there. And there's sort of similar-ish products in the outdoor world, the sort of camping, hiking world. Obviously is ahead of the curve when it comes to portability and lightweightness. And so looking at what was out there and then trying to sort of create a more urban, more robust product that maybe sacrificed a little bit of the ultimate sort of portability or ultimate lightweightness, but added a few more features and made it more practical for the average person going to a coffee shop or taking it to work. So it was a matter of just playing around with seeing what was out there, playing around with concepts on my own. And then once that was sort of in place, then took it to a design agency who work on product and worked in the early days with them to then take that concept, refine it, and then ultimately do what they call design for manufacturing, which is really creating the exact renders and the imagery and the designs that a factory needs to then produce molds to then create the product, which is a sort of technical aspect that I think I didn't have much knowledge of before going down that road.
Well, that's the great thing these days. Anything that you don't know, it's much easier to find somebody who does, right?
I don't know how people did this sort of stuff on the internet.
Yeah, so, drawing it on paper and trying to give somebody else their vision just in a 1D rendition would be difficult. Going back to the crowdfunding, you know, in your bio, we found out that you had viral crowdfunding. Could you talk a little bit about that? Had you had any experience with crowdfunding prior to this, or was this something brand new? Did you again have to go and seek some help with you?
Again, it was just in the early days of anything like this, you're starting from a zero base. So you have to sort of just pick a direction, I think. And we had the product and the product was there and we're ready to manufacture. And then it was a matter of like, how do we get this out into the world? So there's obviously social media and online advertising. Things are a huge asset these days and can be used. So we looked at a bunch of different channels of just launching it sort of from our own social media channels or getting friends to help and expose it or sending it out to media and getting print publications, and then stumbled on crowdfunding, I suppose, something Kickstarter, something I'd been aware of, but never, I think I'd bought stuff on there previously, just playing around, but never something I'd looked at closely. And then when I actually looked at it, realized it's an amazing launch platform. Because you have potentially this huge audience who are sort of actively monitoring new projects and they're actively monitoring what's coming up. And if they like it, they'll really get behind you. So it was as much a way of raising funds to then do a first manufacturing run as it was to build a sort of initial audience, an initial group of supporters who then backed us. And I think one of the aspects of crowdfunding that I didn't think of before we did it was how much that initial support base helped us in the early stages of the business. For example, when we launched on Amazon, it's really useful to get some initial reviews. And so the first thing we did was just went out to our crowdfunding supporters and said, hey, if you are looking to get some cups, do you mind buying them on Amazon and leaving us a review? And it was amazing to see the support we got from that. So the early reviews were people who liked the product, they liked us, they followed the journey from the beginning, felt invested, and then supported us. And so it's an incredible community platform if you do it right.
Oh, that's a great story. So this wasn't the only funding that you had. This was just marketing platform and some funding. So did you bootstrap this? Did you have to get investors? How did you start off?
Yeah, so the early stage was sort of bootstrapped. It was a little bit of my own money, but then there really to do the design work and to get the early stuff with the factory set up. But it was very small amounts. Really, the crowdfunding allowed us, we had a kind of quite a successful campaign, and that gave us cash up front that then allowed us to do a big manufacturing run with the factory and to have inventory that then we could start selling straight off from there. So the crowdfunding was a huge initial step and gave us the sort of initial capital. The problem with product, and particularly this sort of product where you're manufacturing your own, is there's quite a lot of setup costs. Mm. And as the product becomes more complex, the more expensive the setup costs of the factories become, and the design work and the kind of ironing out all things. And it's always more expensive than you think it'll be because there's always something that isn't quite right. So it is a, I think I underestimated how smooth that process would be. We're essentially manufacturing kind of drinking cups. It's not a highly technical product. It's not complex electronics or anything like that. But even in that case, just getting precision in terms of how the lid fits and how durable the silicone is and how it's sturdy but still folds easily, and there's tiny tolerances that need to be tested over and over and over again and get exactly right, because when you have liquid in there, you don't know what it's spilling, but you also don't want the lid to be too tight. So there's all these small things that you don't think of, and as more and more rounds of testing and kind of feedback, obviously it adds expense. And having the crowdfunding money allowed us to do that and get a really good product out.
So how many times do you think you went back to the drawing board to improve the product in order for it to get to be what it has become today? Failure is something you got to go through time and time again, right? Until you get to success.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't tell you in terms of, we obviously had a very first, the product as it is today is a sort of second iteration of it. We had a simpler version of the product initially for that first crowdfunding campaign. And then pretty soon afterwards, we got feedback from our customers, those initial customers, which is also incredibly useful. Getting it out to sort of thousands of people day one gives you this initial feedback, which is really, really useful. So in terms of going back and forth, it was a lot of refinement. We really wanted the product to be as good as it possibly could be, particularly in the Kickstarter world. There's a lot of shortcuts that are often taken, mm-hmm. and you often get a situation where a product's really promised and people have grand visions for it. And then when they get to actually manufacturing, they realize it's not quite as easy as possible as they thought. And you end up getting a kind of inferior product. And in many cases, unfortunately, the product doesn't even get delivered or something mm-hmm. that is very far below what was promised. So we really wanted to over-deliver. Our goal with this wasn't just to create one product and have a quick win. It was to really build a business around that. So we're very aware that the best way to do that was to really over-deliver in terms of product quality. So we did go back and forth for quite a while to make sure that was right. It definitely months of refinement. And then, as I say, once we get feedback from that initial shipment and the initial product, we then went back and sort of redesigned the product a little bit and improved it from feedback and came out with a version 2 that is sort of significantly improved, which is what we have today. So it's an ongoing process to answer your question. We sort of, the product's in a really good space now, but we're always open to kind of feedback, and we're watching how people use it, and we're seeing what can be improved or added to it. So it's an ongoing process.
And then you also have a harder component there because you're using for coffee as well, right? For hot, or tea. You're in London for tea, for yeah. hot drinks. Yeah. So you don't want anybody to get burned. You have a liability there.
Yeah.
So how do you make sure yeah. that, you know, it's a safe product to use?
Yeah. As you say, ultimately you're dealing with hot liquid potentially. I mean, there's only so much you can do. It's an incredibly sturdy product for what it is. And that was one of our focuses, where we wanted it to be something that felt really good in the hand and worked really well. But it is still collapsible. Obviously, if you sort of put hot liquid in there and press on it very hard, it's going to collapse. That is what it's designed to do. So we sort of have to cover ourselves, and we try to put as much information out there. We have a sort of instruction booklet that goes out with each product that says, do this and don't do this, and stuff that should be quite intuitive, but we've learned the hard way that sometimes sort of people have their own versions of how it works. So so you have to sort of trust people to to be careful. There's only so much you can do when you're dealing with that stuff. But in terms of how the product's designed, it's leak proof in terms of how the lid goes on, and if it gets sort of tipped over, it's not going to spill out, and it's not going to collapse without some sort of intentional pressure on it. So we just try to educate as much as possible and make it clear that that's how it works, and just hope that people can sort of use it in the right way. And so far we've sold a lot of these cups and we haven't really had issues with that. I've yet to have anyone come back and ever have a significant issue.
That's great. How about a warranty? Do you have to put how long your product's warrantied for? Because I would think with the wear and tear of collapsing it and standing it up, that it's not going to last forever, right? Do you have a warranty?
We don't have an official warranty, but we do. We've had in hundreds of thousands of these out there, we've had maybe 3 or 4 that people have come back to us where it's actually the wear and tear has sort of opened up a hole in it somehow.
Yeah.
In at least one of those cases, it was because they were using a knife in there. Ooh. To like pick something out. So it is. I think unfortunately with that many being produced, very occasionally you get just a manufacturing sort of weakness where just that particular spot isn't. But overall, we use silicone, which is an incredibly durable material. So theoretically, the testing we've done and the actual day-to-day use we've been using them, they should last fairly indefinitely. Oh, I mean, I don't want to say forever because everything has a time on it, but silicone is an incredibly durable material and we design them to be able to fold and unfold a lot. So I've using them all day, every day, and I've yet to have any issue. As I say, occasionally that we've had a handful over the years, and I think those are largely probably just unfortunately sort of manufacturing that missed a quality control at the factory.
Wow.
But very, 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 very minimal.
Yeah, that's great. What about certifications? Do you need to have any certifications on this product? Is there any kind of FDA? I'm in the United States.
Yeah. So there are, obviously you need sort of certain certifications that are, because it's a food product. So the FDA in the United States has a certification. What that has to do with is largely the materials. So obviously using certain materials, you can't just sort of make a product that interacts with food out of anything, because potentially there's bad stuff in there. So we use materials that are FDA certified, which is the US version. And then there's the LFGB, which is the European version, which is actually a lot stricter than the American version. So
surprise.
Everything that the FDA covers. Yeah, everything that the FDA covers, the LFGB, which is a German standard, is even more stringent. And those are sort of the baseline. You really shouldn't, if a product doesn't have those two, I would be very wary of it. That's a sort of base standard. And then we also have certifications of our factories are audited in terms of working standards and all that sort of stuff. And we obviously trying to build a very ethical business. So there's a lot of other certifications we also have that some people like to see, but they aren't necessary to operate. The food standard ones are sort of the requirements.
Okay.
But on top of that, we definitely over certify and make sure we're working with the right people.
Well, and that's a great segue into my next topic, which is how do you go about finding the right match for you for manufacturing? And, you know, where do you do that? Do you manufacture it? It's difficult, right?
It's a good question. I would, my short answer is it's highly product specific. We've looked actually around the world. We've looked in Europe. We looked in the US. We've looked in Mexico. Ultimately, no one can do what China can do for our type of product, both from a quality perspective and just from a technical expertise perspective, and obviously cost. What is unfortunate is that there's a sort of backlash to the Chinese manufactured product, but ultimately because of the politics and because of sort of what people hear, but ultimately I deal with the people on the ground all day, every day, and they're amazingly ethical, hardworking, really incredible people, and they make a very good product. And I think the end consumer ultimately does want a better priced product.
Oh yeah.
So from our perspective, it's getting the highest quality product for the best price is actually going to have the most good in the long run, because we're just getting more exposure out there and people are buying it. And it's the difference. We have tried in the US and just have yet to find anything that even comes close. And it's not even a cost issue. It's just the ability, the flexibility in order to sort of refine designs and to do minimum order quantities. And just the Chinese are very, very good at manufacturing, and they're very customer focused. And that's incredible to work with, especially when you're sort of in the early stage and you want people to get behind you. So the short question is, I think for certain products, there's certain areas of the world, like for textiles, obviously there's parts of the world that are kind of coming up, places like Portugal and Turkey. And so China isn't the best solution for everything, but for our sort of product, there's no way we found that compares. And in terms of finding a manufacturer, it's a tough one to answer. There's a lot of online resources. Let me back that one. There's a lot of online resources now, especially with sort of the amount of information and things like AI. There's sort of a lot more access easily to the information of, you can actually see what factories various competitors use or similar product use, and you actually find those people. The way we did it was really word of mouth. We were advised a factory, and we're now in our third manufacturer, and each one has progressively just sort of, we've got a better situation and improved our relationship. But it is an ongoing process. You unfortunately don't know until you actually start manufacturing. And it has a lot to do with, especially when you're dealing with a foreign country, with communication. That's a huge part of it. I would say it'd be very, very wary of promises without evidence. And I think optimize for just very clear, honest communication. That's a huge part. Even if you have to pay slightly more for your product, even if there's other stuff maybe you have to sacrifice on, having a team out there that you can rely on and you trust in that gets back to you. Because when things go wrong, or when you need something fixed, or when there's some sort of crisis, being able to trust that they're there is a huge, huge, huge thing. And then secondly, I would say in the early stages, you are limited by your order quantities. Mm-hmm. So the best sort of priced, most highest quality or best manufacturer might be hard to work with for your particular type of product, because you just can't meet the order volumes. And that's where having some sort of evidence that there's demand for it, having some sort of business plan, having investors possibly, whatever you can get to back yourself up and prove to them that it's worth them taking a risk on you. Because any time they spend on your product, they make their money on volume.
I'm just curious, so what would you say would be a minimum volume? You know, if off the top of your head, are we talking hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands when you're just starting off?
Again, hugely product dependent and hugely factory dependent. There are smaller factories that are going to do. For example, there are sampling factories where you can get 5 units done, but you're going to pay a lot for them. They're not sort of commercially viable, but you might need them as proof to take to a retailer or to investors. So there are ways. What I would say is there's ways of doing this stuff. I think some of the most successful product businesses I've seen that sort of bootstrapped it came from a situation where they took a sort of existing product and refined it rather than starting completely from scratch. And that allows you to go to a factory that already produces that and say, hey, can we just do this or tweak this? And it makes it a much easier setup for them. If you're designing completely from scratch, it's something completely unique, and what you need to do there is then create an entirely new set of sort of manufacturing mold, whatever your product is. In our case, we use injection molding. So we actually have to create metal molds, and that's a whole process. And those need to be tested and refined. And it's a lot of work for a factory to do. You pay for those, but still they're not making money on those until you start producing. So really as much evidence as you can up front is you might end up being able to get lower order quantities for your first order because you can show proof that actually this is our plan and we're going to build up quite quickly and there is demand for this. Whereas if you're going in sort of as a one-man band with no proof and just an idea, it's probably a little bit harder. So the more credibility you can build up, the more leverage you have, basically.
Gotcha. And you mentioned resources on the internet to help you find manufacturers. Do you know of any off the top of your head, or, you know, Mr. Google's a good way to go?
Yeah, I would say Google is not something, as I say, we've already started off with recommendations from the early stages from people we knew and designers we worked with, and have sort of evolved from there. But there are a lot of websites. I think a Google search would bring up something very quickly. And there are resources, and I can't think of them off the top of my head, for example, where you can look at a sort of competitor. You can actually look at their import records and see exactly where their products are. There's a lot of sort
like
of
reverse engineering.
Yeah, you can reverse engineer a lot of the stuff. It's all out there. As you said earlier, that everything is out there now. It's the only limitation is sort of how much digging are you willing to do to get to it. Some of it's buried quite deep, but it is all there. There's records of almost everything, which is terrifying, but it makes it amazing if you're starting something new, because you really can look at what other people have done and reverse engineer.
Oh, fantastic. All right. One last question about manufacturing, and that's due diligence. You said, you know, you want to do work with a company who has a good track record. They're doing what they say. You don't want any pollution, any bad stuff coming out of your manufacturing process, what they're doing. So are there any kind of ISO standards that you look for, or what would you look for in a manufacturer? Track record, certifications, and so forth.
Yeah, the certifications, there's a whole bunch, and I'm not even going to pretend to know the actual, sure. they're all quite technically numbered and labeled, and there's a lot of that's sort of work standards and emissions, and there's a lot of stuff. So those I would say are sort of table stakes. Like you should have that as a very base minimum. The way we've gone about it from early on is working through, and actually it probably applies to your previous question, is working with on the ground agents who are kind of come recommended through people we trust. So what they do is they then work with factories that fit criteria and that they've vetted. And so you're sort of building a partnership with people who are on the ground and make sure that everything is as it should be, or as it's being promised, because I think there's a lot of stuff where you sort of, and famously how many large corporations, I mean, there was a lot of sort of Apple and Nike and all the big guys sort of being caught out for factories promising certain standards when no one actually bothered to check that those standards were being met. And then some pretty horrible stuff came out about them. So having someone on the ground who you trust, whether it's a team who has the same interests as you do, is the way we've gone about it. Obviously, the best case scenario is actually physically going out there and meeting and building a relationship with the factory and making sure everything is as it is and checking up it. And that's really the way you should do it. Yeah, as I say, in our case, we now work with a factory who's actually got an entire UK team. So they're based in London, and they have a factory out there, and it's incredibly sort of high standards. So that's the way we've gone about it. But as I say, the baseline is actually seeing for yourself. And there's a lot of documentation that can be done, and there's independent auditors that go to these factories and apply these standards and make sure it's all met. And then there's a lot of sort of agency type teams like what we've worked with that go out and actually vet the stuff and I suppose you work with them to make sure everything is as it should be.
Do you communicate any of this information with your customers? Like, we manufacture this product and it's all done by these standards. Just wondering if that's a plus from a marketing perspective.
It is. I wouldn't say we communicate it sort of actively, purely because it's quite a lot of information. We obviously have our, I suppose, company mission in terms of the way we operate and the way we manufacture products and the types of things we do. And that's just saying we do it in a certain way. And we're obviously, our goal from the beginning was to sort of use less plastic, and that sort of informs everything else we do in terms of how we do it and we do it ethically. All that information is there, and we work with a lot of corporate clients, and some of them need it because they all have to sort of tick boxes, and we have it all available. But to sort of the average consumer doesn't necessarily know what a sort of certain factory audit document actually means. So it almost takes away from the messaging sometimes. So we try to do it in as a sort of accessible way as possible. But it is all there if anyone wants to see it.
Yeah, gotcha. Okay, we'll move out of the manufacturing part and looking at your website, it says that you were on, what show is it? Good Morning. No, I always get those talk shows. Today Show. You're on the Today Show. I get that mixed up with Good Morning America. Sorry about that. But how did you get on that show, or your product get on the show?
So a lot of our marketing from that sense is we've had some sort of good media stuff has been inbound, people contacting us. I think the product is unique. People really liked it. And we had some really good virality on the social front. And I think that's how the Today Show got hold of us. And they had their sort of product of the summer. And they picked us as the number one, which is really good for us. And it's great.
Did you get to go on the
show? Yeah.
Were you actually on the show? No. They're just your product?
No, it was just a segment on the product. And that came really about through social. I would say, I mean, that's social really is, this isn't a secret at all, but it is the biggest hack. If you apply your effort into one space, it should be that. The marketing is such a crucial part of it. I think the tendency for all of us is to go very heavy on the product and to really think, oh, if we have a great product, people will come. Mm. But there's so much noise out there at the moment. And even from a retailer point of view, so much of our retail contacts and our distribution has come because people have seen us on social and contacted us. It's a lot easier to market than to sell.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk about that. I wanted to talk about your marketing and your social media. So you're on Instagram. What other social platforms do you use?
Instagram has really been our focus. We sort of do odd things on TikTok and we've worked with some influencers and things like that. But Instagram has really been the base of everything for a few reasons. It's really where we launched and we had good success early on. And it's the type of audience that I think works for us and people are a bit more engaged. In an ideal world, and this is ultimately where we want to be, is you want to be on everything all the time as loud as possible. But just in terms from a resource point of view, I think your best solution early on is to pick a platform and really do it. Focus your efforts on there. TikTok is obviously an incredible platform and the sort of virality element of that. It's getting more and more. It's getting louder and louder. It's harder to break through, but it's still, you can. I mean, I see it every day, businesses that transform overnight through one video. And
right.
I can attest to this on the Instagram perspective. We had our most viral video ever was something that almost didn't get posted because it was sort of, we just need to put something up. It got put up. Wow. And it just, for whatever reason, clicked. And so that would be my one piece of advice on social is you really don't know what's going to work. Like you think you do. And the stuff we've put the most effort in went nowhere. And the thing that was filmed in 1 minute because we just had to get something up that day ended up going crazy. So it's wow. Just keep plugging away at it. Yeah. And try to be sort of honest and authentic. And obviously below that, have a good product.
Mm-hmm.
That helps.
Sure. So do you have a TikTok shop, going back to TikTok? So I see those products, certain products that I see and that I like, and
yeah,
they just keep coming up in my feed from lots of other people trying to sell it, you know, influencers.
TikTok is a crazy world. We haven't gone down that route. We've very focused on distribution at the moment of getting the product into retailers. So that's really our focus right now. So we've sort of let up on our own e-commerce a little bit and really focusing on getting it in through distributors into as many stores as we can. We're lucky in that we have a product that works sort of worldwide and it appeals in many different countries. So we're just trying to get as much coverage as possible. That's our focus right now. So
where can people find the Hunu Cup?
Online, the most reliable spot really at the moment is Amazon. Outside of that is, I'm not even going to start rattling off the retailers, but they're sure. Retailers in the US, Europe, the UK, Australia, the Middle East. We sell a lot. South Africa, Iceland, we have retailers. So there's a lot of retailers. Our sort of original point of sale was really the environmental side and eco stores and independents. And as we've grown, we're sort of moving it more into more traditional retailers. The sports world has really taken up because it's really portable. It can be thrown in the back of a cycling bib or taken on a run. Then the travel world as well, just in terms of something you can throw in a bag and take to the airport and have with you and use in a hotel room or when you're backpacking. So that's where we're sort of gradually expanding out into more and more different diverse retailers. And ultimately our goal is to get it into really as many retailers as possible and have it available to people everywhere.
I know this is a big question and has a big answer, but just in a nutshell about, you know, starting off going to anybody these days can upload something and sell on Amazon. Really, I make it sound easy, but it takes the work. But to get into a company, a distributor, do you go, you make a phone call, you show up and you say, hey, I have this cup and I want you to sell it. Do you email or do you hire somebody to do that for you? Like I said, I know it's a big, big question.
No, it's a great question. All of it.
Okay.
Would be my answer. It all works. These days, the most effective route by far is to have them come to you.
Okay.
So if you can build, and this comes back to the social thing, if you can have proof of concept, we were incredibly lucky and we had this Kickstarter success that sort of got some attention and ultimately led to people coming to us, retailers and things. So that, and we, it, the amount of effort it takes to market well and to have people come to you is a lot easier than the amount of effort it takes to actually go and looking for them. Saying that, obviously, if you have a good sales situation and you're a good salesman, that is absolutely a route as well. If you have a good product and you have proof of concept and you have customers and you have everything lined up, then obviously you want to go out as much as possible and find distributors and speak to retailers individually. And it depends hugely on your product and depends on the business you're trying to build. I think if you have a good product and you're a startup and it's sort of you're doing it on a small scale, just finding relevant retailers and approaching them directly and building up relationships is a really way to go. As you expand, you want to get more into distributors who are sort of specific on that. Those distributors then have relationships with all the stores. And so instead of getting in one store by one store, you getting into 1,000 stores at once or 100 stores at once, depending on what it is. Obviously, there's so many other considerations there where your sort of product margins come down a lot and you've got to get more volume. So there's a lot of business considerations, and it depends what you want to do and how you want to grow. But ultimately, these days, the world we live in and the beauty of the internet, the beauty of social media is if you do have an interesting product, if you do have something good, something that people like, and you are dedicated and good at producing content and getting it out to people, the retailers will find you. Especially if you have some sort of virality or if they can see that people buy it. I mean, retailers are looking for stuff that sells. Mm-hmm. So, and they are monitoring that. Especially we found that the big retailers will often approach viral products because they want to have them in store because they all want to be sort of ahead of the game slightly and have the next best thing in there. So the easiest thing you can do is really be out there as much as possible.
Going back to Amazon real quick, you know, yours isn't the only foldable cup that's on there. How do you make yours stand out from others?
Yeah, Amazon's got trickier. It's a sort of side platform for us, and we get good sales through there. But it's something we sort of let tick over. Amazon is become very much a pay to play type platform where you pay for advertising on there if you want to scale it. So you stand out that way by actually putting money behind it and showing up first in search rankings. But in terms of the product itself, we designed it this way, and there've been a lot more collapsible cups that have come along since we launched, but really nothing can compete with us in terms of the sort of durability, the sturdiness and quality relative to the collapsibility. We're by far the slimmest, highest quality product out there. There's some very cheap knockoff products you can buy sort of four or something, sort of Chinese things that are made with actually sometimes quite dangerous materials. Mm-hmm. We found like, definitely not certified, that also will wear and tear and will collapse probably if you pour too much in them. So we stand out. Really, our initial USP was that it is the slimmest cup out there. It's the most, it collapses the smallest relative to our largest cup is a 20-ounce cup, which is decent size. Mm-hmm. And that you can fold down and carry in a pocket. And that was really what we went in. It's an incredibly good travel product. And then aside from that, it's very high quality in the sense of once it's unfolded and once it's up, it's sturdy enough that you can hold it and pour stuff in there and not worried about it kind of collapsing like a lot of other products.
Now, you said USP, and most people know what that means, but not always. Everybody knows that. So it's the unique selling proposition, right? USP?
Yes. Yeah. Sort of your point of difference. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we live in a world of acronyms and not everybody knows all the acronyms. So I want to talk about your corporate selling, right? You have I thought this was very interesting, but you have a wholesale program and you have branding for outside companies. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So a decent part of our business is, corporate product. So that varies. That sort of runs the spectrum of promotional product, the type of thing that we work with some really amazing brands. We've worked with Netflix and Amazon, a lot of luxury brands, Jaguar. We work with the Mercedes-Benz Formula E, which is the electronic F1 team. So it's all sort of there on the sustainability spectrum as well in terms of less emissions. So it would be, for example, you'd go to a Formula One race and they'd have our product there with the Mercedes-Benz branding on it. So it ranges from that all the way through to, there's Mercedes, for example, runs all the way through to corporate gifting. A lot of corporates really like it. And I think probably that one on the top left might've been a corporate gift. I'm not actually sure, but they sort of hand out to employees or partners at the end of a year. So there's a huge industry for that. And if you have a unique product and something that fits well into some sort of sustainability or something kind of more positive, corporates like that. And in our case, it worked really well because eating and drinking products, and especially drinking products, the thermos cups are really popular gifts and they're really popular promotional products. And ours is a unique take on that. And it's something that, and part of our packaging and the way we display it works really well. It sort of sits a little bit different and it's very easy to brand and it's something that people like. So it is a really good income stream if you have a product that fits in that world.
Now, did you say that this was a big proportion of your sales?
It's hugely variable because it's sort of year to year, but I would say 20%. Probably comes from that currently. And it's something we're sort of expanding into a little bit more. So as we sort of scale.
Okay. So this is an audio only podcast, but for listeners, we're doing this video as well. So I'm pulling some things up on my screen that Vince is commenting on, which we were just talking about the corporate branding.
Yes.
Yeah. So just so you know that, but now we talked about the design and the foldability, but I want to get into the nitty gritty of the product itself and how wonderful it is, because I don't think we've communicated that well enough. So if you could explain, I mean, you have the silicone straw and it's a different shape than a regular straw. You have the packaging is amazing. It's minimalist packaging. If you could talk about that, I think that would help the listeners really get an idea of your product.
Yeah. So on the product, I'll start with the product. As I say, ultimately, we sort of started with this concept of you sort of start with pretty basic design criteria. And our criteria was to have something that functions incredibly well for both hot and cold drinks. And that was sturdy and as close to a actual proper mug as, or like a sturdy mug as possible, but then could be carried around in a pocket. And so then you sort of start there and then you got to start making compromises. Okay, obviously it can't be as sturdy as a thermos cup. So how flexible do we make it? And you sort of start playing around. And then once you have that basic sort of iteration and it works really, really well, then you start playing with the design elements of things like you've mentioned, the straw is a slightly different shape. That was just something we looked at and really liked how that fitted kind of in your mouth, and it was a nice straw to drink out of, and the opening of our cups are that shape, so it fits in there, and you can start sort of refining and then you sort of work from there into the design elements of where the logo sits and visually how it looks and the colors. And it's a sort of layer by layer approach of covering the very basic elements of just a cup that collapses and works really well as a cup to then how what makes it a nicer drinking experience. How can we change the way there's a lip on the lid, for example, it's sort of indented. That's because sometimes when you take a sip, there's a little drip that comes out and you don't want it falling off. You want it going back into the hole. So there's sort of small things that you refine over time just as you use it. And then ultimately you get to a product where you've sort of created something that's not only works to do what you want it to do, but it also is a real pleasure to use. And I think one of the things that is people always comment on, and I love it to this day, is you don't get, unless you actually have a product in hand, of how satisfying it is to collapse, to sort of unfold and fold. It's a very firm kind of satisfying. It's quite a nice experience. It feels very sturdy and firm. And that's something we worked very hard to do, just from the exact thickness and the style of silicone and the way the folds worked. And so there's a lot of intricate design that goes into each tiny bit. And it's a beautiful process to be part of. But you don't appreciate it as a consumer because you don't think about it. You just want a product that works really well. But it takes sort of quite a lot of attention to detail to get that experience. And sometimes you don't even realize you're having the experience of just that satisfying pop or the sound it makes. And then from a packaging point of view, yeah, packaging is an interesting one. We originally optimized for mailer packaging. And the idea was we wanted to create something that actually could fit through a mailbox. It was sort of a cup that you can, it's a drinking cup you can get through your mailbox. And so it's very slim, minimalist packaging. Obviously, we wanted to keep it as minimal as possible and not use unnecessary materials. And it's been people love the packaging. So it's just something we actually created very early on and sort of stayed the same. And it works really well in retail. So it's been a win from day one, that packaging.
Yeah, I absolutely love that from a design perspective and also a green perspective. You know, the less packaging, the better. And it's just so compact. I give you a lot of credit for that. That's great.
Thank you. Yeah, that is.
Well, we're getting close to the end of our time. Can you share some advice? I mean, you've shared some great advice and we really appreciate it. We being myself and the listeners. But is there anything else you'd like to share? You know, they could help somebody with their business. Oh, let me ask you this too. So how many people do you employ? Are you a large organization or are you a small organization?
No, we're relatively small. We work with a lot of, I wouldn't say freelancers, they're sort of steady ongoing partners. So if you take into account all the sort of design and the team and the graphics and the web and all that sort of stuff, it expands quite quickly. But in terms of our core organization, we're a relatively small team and we try to keep quite nimble. Really, right now, our biggest thing we're trying to grow out is more sales staff, because that's our focus, is on getting the product into more retailers. But I think the nice thing these days is with the internet and with remote working and with the way people are working, there's a lot of incredible talent that kind of want to work on a project by project basis. So you can have incredibly high quality people and people who are sort of working from anywhere in the world. You have the pick of everyone. And you can pick them up and use people on a project-by-project basis. As we sort of did more web design, for example, and we did more online advertising, we built out a team that was based in the US and Europe and all over that works on our ads and advertising. And now as we're dealing with more sales staff, we have kind of more on-the-ground people in Europe and the UK actually working on selling. So I think it's a good piece of advice. Moving on to that, I think stay as lean as possible for as long as possible. Would be my advice. If you can, unless you have huge amounts of investment and you're sort of very comfortable, which is a nice situation to be in, but most of us aren't, really, really stay lean and try to do as much as possible with a small team until you get to a point where you're sort of bursting at the seams and then you have to maybe hire more full time, because you can use a lot of outsourced work really effectively. And it doesn't tie you into overheads, because things, especially in the early days, you're sort of relying on fewer customers and you're relying on things going right. If one thing goes wrong, it can be make or break. Whereas as you grow, you get a bit more stable and a bit more sort of less fragile, where you can afford to bring on more overhead. But yeah, the early days, stay lean and optimize for selling. Enough. Really, that's what you want to do. You just want to get as product out to as many people as possible, which is a lesson that we've learned. I'm very brand focused and kind of product focused. And I think in our early stage, I optimized building the brand, which worked really well in some senses. But also, I think in hindsight, if I had to go back, I would probably really just focus on selling product and getting as much exposure as possible and then building it up from there once you have a good sort of income base.
Oh, that's great advice. And how can people get in touch with you? Your website is wearehunu.com and it's WEARE, hunu.com.
Yeah. We are.
We are. That's why I keep getting confused. No, I'm sorry. Yeah, we are.
It's a common.
Because it has a loop, yeah, right? You can actually wear it on your belt loop. Isn't that right? Or no?
No, not current, okay. Not in its current iteration, okay. Although we are okay. Working on some products that actually allow that. Yeah, we are hunu.com,
we are.
Okay. HUNU. You can get hold of us through there. And yeah, if you want to get in touch with me, I'm Vince Dixon. I'm that on most socials. Instagram's probably the easiest. So yeah, reach out. I'm happy. I love the space. I love sort of startups and product and very happy to help anyone that wants to chat about anything as much help as I can be. It's a few things we've learned, but that's definitely an ongoing process, and it's not an easy ride. But you there's a lot of growth, a lot of personal growth, a lot of learnings. It's a good challenge to take on.
All right, great. Well, thank you again for joining us on the podcast today.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, great. Thanks, Anne.
Wow, we covered a lot of ground in that interview. I think this is a really good blueprint for building on an existing product that can benefit people and the planet while making it better. Here's some of my favorite takeaways from the interview. First, getting feedback and recommendations in the very early stages of product development is very important. If you're building on an existing product, use products that are already out there. You can actually look at their import records and see exactly where their products are being made and how they're being made. Reverse engineering a product that you're looking to improve is a great learning tool. When moving on to the manufacturing stages, when you're looking for options for manufacturing, having a team on the ground who can recommend locations is important. Tell them what criteria you're looking for, and they can help you find people to work with and factories that fit criteria that have already been vetted, so you don't have to worry about that. On a social media aspect of things, You never know which social media posts are going to be successful, so keep trying. Even if you don't think it's a great post, just post it. Nike has Just Do It, and now we have Just Post It. Social media-wise, retailers are also monitoring social media platforms for products that are selling, have a large following, and an interactive community. It can be especially beneficial to them if they can be ahead of other retailers and get your product to market first. We've all heard before, you need to have a good, unique selling proposition, or USP, in order to stand out from competitors. It's a very noisy world out there, a lot of products, a lot of people. How are you going to stand out? And lastly, stay as lean as possible for as long as possible. Great advice. Please take a minute and go check out Hunu Cups at wearehunu.com. That's wearehunu.com. And if you want to connect with Vince, the best way to do this is on Instagram at Vince Dixon. Thank you again for listening. I hope you enjoy the rest of your day. Thanks so much for listening to the Green Business All-Star Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, I'd appreciate it if you would subscribe, like, and or follow the show on your favorite podcast app. Also appreciate it if you would leave us a review to help us share our mission and the mission of our guests to make the world a better place while sustaining a comfortable lifestyle. Peace to the planet, people, and making a profit.